This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Wow, I like that. When Chris is taking a more serious tone, it is, what is up with that? Rather,
it's very proper.
What's up with that?
Not that we stole that from anywhere.
No, exactly. Speaking of which.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a woman who, unlike John Boehner, never cries, Janie Skull.
No tears. No tears in baseball.
No tears in baseball, Janie. You know, Janie's got a bad cold, but she's going to power through this one.
Yeah, no. I mean, I'm certainly not going to cry about it. That's for sure.
Nice. Nicely said. We've got some guest co-hosts this month because Rick Hess is
traveling the world again.
Yep. He's slacking it. He's there in Hawaii enjoying a vacation, a much-deserved vacation.
Very true.
He had a very productive 2010.
Maybe he'll enjoy it as much as Georgia this past summer, I hope.
Yes. And meanwhile, we've got Checker Finn circumnavigating Sumatra. So, you know, those of us sort of right of center education policy wonks, there's not many of us actually here, you know, holding down the fort. So
we were here all the holidays. We never stopped, Mike. I know.
Did you notice that Education Gadfly came out on December 22nd? That's right. Everybody else had closed up shop, and we were still going strong.
Mm-hmm.
Going strong. We're going strong here today on the podcast. Let's get going and play a game of Pardon the Gadfly.
Question number one. States nationwide are facing massive budget holes. Do they have little choice but to lay off young teachers, scrap art and music programs, and take other draconian steps?
Why no, Daniela?
This seems to be a little biased, maybe a little pointed.
Can you tell when I write the questions? That's an excellent question.
I think they can only take draconian steps.
Is that right, Jamie?
Yes,
that's
only,
their only option.
Only.
All right, so this week, Marguerite Rosa and I came out with a policy brief. Marguerite is now at the Gates Foundation, though she's on leave from the Center on Reinventing Public Education at the University of Washington, and knows this stuff 1,000 times better than I do. But what this brief tries to do is be very clear to policymakers at the state level about how to go about these budget cuts. The key message is this. The absolute worst thing they can do is just cut the funds and do nothing else. Because if that happens at the local level, if you're a superintendent, even if you want to do the right thing, if there's a state law on, you know, saying last hired, first fired, if there are state tenure protections for teachers that you can't get around, if there are statewide salary schedules you've got to follow, if there's statewide mandates on class size, you are boxed in. And you're going to have to do things like lay off the art and music teachers, lay off the young teachers, scrap all kinds of other programs, you know, cut busing service, lower the thermostat, on and on and on. You can't do the things that are actually best for kids.
What I think was interesting in this policy brief you're talking about is that a lot of people think that, you know, furlough Fridays, things like that, cutting the day, cutting the school year will actually save money. But in the end, you're actually paying people more per hour then. So then you kind of get stuck in the cycle of having higher salaries, which in the end is actually more expensive. So it's kind of the exact opposite of what you're actually going for when you take the steps in the first place.
That's right. And look, you know, teacher salaries and other staff salaries and benefits are the huge cost drivers in these education systems. The problem is, you know, school boards will sign off on these contracts that have these huge escalators where there's a cost of living increase, but people also get more money every year. The healthcare stuff can easily get out of control, where a lot of these teachers and other staff are not paying hardly anything for their healthcare insurance, and those costs are escalating. The pension systems are going bust. I mean, so on all kinds of fronts, there hasn't been any controls. And so now, look, you know, we're going to have to be talking about things like reining in teacher salaries, redesigning compensation, reining in the benefits for sure. That's not going to be comfortable conversations to have. But the other options are doing things that directly harm kids. And the question is, can we squeeze out some of these costs from the education system while protecting the programs that are good for children?
I guess my question at the end of the day is whether superintendents and the people in charge are actually going to take these steps, these positive steps,
right,
or are they just going to do the usual, you know, cut, cut, cut,
right,
not really pay attention? Do they have the political cover to even make these steps in the first place?
Well, and from this perspective is, first of all, the states have to do their job. And there are a lot of these state laws and mandates have been written in by teacher unions and other interest groups that tie the district's hands. So first you got to untie their hands. And then, yes, you've got to have the political cover at the local level to do the right thing. It's going to be tough. And, you know, we're going to see people protesting in the streets this spring all over the country as these cuts come down. And it's going to be a tough thing to watch. Okay, next question, Daniela.
Democratic legislators in Illinois are pushing a far-reaching teacher tenure reform bill modeled after the one that passed in Colorado this summer. Many of these legislators accepted campaign contributions from reform-minded Stand for Children. Is this good news that reformers are getting into the political arena via campaign cash, or is it a bit unseemly?
I mean, I would say this is the lesser of two evils. You know, I don't think that people should feel beholden to someone who sponsors their campaign. But at the same time, when all you have is unions sponsoring campaigns and throwing lots of money into campaigns, I think there is a need for kind of a counterbalancing force. And if Stand for Children is going to be that force, then, you know, I think that's probably a positive thing.
Right. So now we've got a couple of examples in the states, at least, where this kind of political action has been getting some results. Here in Illinois, okay, you've got some legislators who are now pushing a reform-minded agenda. And again, this is a state that's still under Democratic control. In Colorado this last summer, when they first passed this big tenure bill, it was led by Democratic legislator Mike Johnston, a real reformer. And he got some other Democrats on board who were very nervous, because they're in, you know, tough seats with re-elections, and they were worried that if they lost the backing of the teacher unions, they'd have no money to run with and defeat the Republicans. Well, they raised a bunch of cash from the reformers to offset it. This is, of course, what Michelle Reese says she's going to do, is to raise, you know, do this on steroids. So it's going to be interesting to see. I do worry, though, this, you know, it might work the first couple of times as the union hasn't adjusted. But once they figure this out, look, they raise their dues by $10 a person. Exactly. You know, they can raise millions and millions of dollars to counter it. So,
well, I guess that goes into what some states are trying to do right now, which is to limit, you know, to have people opt in to,
right.
You know, when they pay fees to unions, whether they can use it for political campaigns, and having blocking unionized teachers from the right to strike when, you know, something does fall through, or something, they don't like something, or yeah. I think there's a lot going on that's actually trying to proactively counterbalance these forces before they actually come to fruition and really try to derail policies.
In the short term, though, I think we're going to see a little bit of an arms race around this campaign cash. Okay, topic number three, Daniela.
All interesting stuff. This is my favorite question of the day. A front page New York Times article on New Year's Day discussed smart video cameras that are being used to enhance prison security, alert the staff if patients in nursing homes are not doing too well, and so forth. Would such cameras be beneficial if placed in classrooms or school hallways?
So we discussed, I believe, a few weeks ago, the big Gates-funded project to use cameras in classrooms to evaluate teachers. Now, those cameras only go in four times a year. Teachers are agreeing to this. So it's used in a very specific way. But hey, it's not hard to believe that you would have get to a point where there's a camera in every classroom on all the time, in hallways and the cafeterias everywhere, that could be used for evaluating teachers, holding them accountable, for parents to watch their kids from home for security purposes. Why not, Janie? Why not?
I guess my hesitation with this is that it's not necessary. Yes, there are probably, you could go through and name some benefits to having a camera in a classroom, such as the way that they were talking about this. Cameras can actually recognize kind of facial expressions or movements to say, oh, there's a fight is going to break out, or someone's not paying attention. And yes, that's probably, you know, in some cases beneficial, but the negatives definitely outweigh the positives here. I just don't think it's necessary to have Big Brother in the classroom 24/7 looking at what you're doing. I don't know how it's really going to help the teacher in that moment, you know, kind of take a piece of information and immediately be able to respond to it. I just don't really see, I mean, and maybe, I don't know, maybe they'll come up with technology that really is beneficial to the teacher in the moment, but I just don't see how that's going to be possible.
See, I think you put little zappers on the seats, right? And so if the kid is like, you know, they caught looking at their smartphone or, you know, texting, there's a little, you know, electric charge. This is, you know, and then
much like a dog collar, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. I think that works fine. Like, I mean, Big Brother, come on. I'm not saying this is going to get hooked up to some line that goes to the White House here. I mean, this is, you know, schools have always had ways of having discipline.
But does it need to be the White House? I mean, is the principal enough? I mean, I think having one teacher in one classroom should be able to control that classroom without.
Do they have eyes in the back of their heads?
No, but they should be able to control the classroom. Teachers have been doing it for thousands of years. And yes, in some classes may be unruly, and some classes, you know, maybe could benefit from something like this. But I just don't think on average, the general classroom needs this type of device.
No, well, I think that there's going to be some interesting experimenting going on out there. There's already a company that will sell to preschools or daycare centers these video cameras and the whole system so that parents can sign on at their office computer and watch little Johnny all day long and see how he's doing. There's no way that those parents are going to want to give that up once Johnny goes to kindergarten and on from there. I think this is coming. And, you know, I think with appropriate safeguards, it can be a useful tool.
I think those parents have too much time on their hands.
Yes. And by the way, yes, as the Fordham offices now will be moving to these video cameras as well, just to make sure we'll looking over your shoulder at any time, saying, you know, stop looking at Facebook.
No YouTube.
Back to work. Okay. Thank you, Daniela. Thank you, Janie. Well played. It is now time for everyone's favorite Amber's Research Minute. Amber. Amber. Welcome back to the show.
How you doing? Nice to be here after a restful vacation.
I know, but
not
poor Amber.
Yeah,
Amber took a vacation, was planning to go to New York City.
Yes, I was. And then the blizzard. 2 feet. So no New York trip for me.
I know. And you were going to go see that Al Pacino show.
Al Pacino, Merchant of Venice. That was really, really excited about that. Nice. Yes, that was $400 ticket, second row out the window. So.
Wow.
You know, anywho. I think maybe you write a note to Al and explain the situation. Maybe send him a link to the podcast so he sees your good work on trying to fix America's education problem. And, you know, maybe he'll cut you some slack.
Maybe, maybe.
Seems like a nice guy.
Yeah.
Well, not in all the roles that he played.
Like the Godfather.
Except when he's killing people.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. So, Amber, what you got for us for the first research minute of 2011?
I hope it's I hope this foretends good things for the minute. We're looking at the new study called Choice Without Options, published by AEI. Rick is not here, of course. Conducted by our friend Mark Schneider, former NCS commissioner who's now at AIR. He examined school choice in D.C., specifically whether high-quality options exist for students who choose to transfer to other schools. Presumably, these are students who previously attend a school that didn't make AYP under NCLB. I'm going to assume everybody knows what that is. So first, a little background. Recall that in D.C., 70% of students attend a school other than their zone neighborhood school. D.C. has roughly 90 charter and 120 traditional schools. Snyder examines the choices available to roughly 12,000 D.C. students who transferred schools in 2009-10. He finds that fewer than one-third of them enrolled in a school that had demonstrated higher proficiency, which he defines as both performing better than the average school and performing better over time. Almost three-fourths enrolled in schools that had lower proficiency or had undetermined proficiency, meaning they had less than 4 years of testing data, so he couldn't really tell. In the end, 52% of charter schools had undetermined status and 64% of traditional schools had lower proficiency. Last little takeaway, the most common choice among transfers was to attend a charter school of unknown proficiency, which makes sense since so many had unknown proficiency. In the end, he concludes that parents appear to be hedging their bets that charter schools will provide a better education than traditional schools. So D.C. has choice, but it's not real choice in terms of quality choices.
Yeah, there's not much in the choosing.
Right. Not much in the choosing. So anyway, it was an interesting little study. It was one of those education outlooks that AI does. So it was kind of short and pithy and got to the point, and I like it.
Yeah. I mean, what you said at the beginning is one of the most interesting things to me. The fact that choice is so widespread in D.C. I mean, we already know we're up to what now, 35% maybe of the kids in charter schools about that. And then there's a lot of public school choice within the city in the district schools themselves. And part of that is because it's a small, actually relatively small city, geographically pretty good public transportation. It's feasible in a place like D.C. For kids to go to schools in other wards of the city. And they do all the time. But this tells us again that, you know, parents are not looking at test scores necessarily as the sole indicator.
Right. Or they're just trusting that, hey, this is not my zone traditional school. It's charter. Maybe charter, you know, like you said, they're hedging their bets. And I think that was, I like that phrase. I think it was very accurate because they just don't have the information. So like no information is better than the information that my school is not doing well.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's interesting that they're just being proactive enough to keep transferring the kids. I mean, it sounds like if your school's doing that bad, yeah, exactly. And you just want to go anywhere. But to even have the knowledge of, you know, these charters exist, they could be better. You know, you have to definitely know about that and you have to be informed. And I think that's fascinating that 70% of, you know, of these students' parents are kind of on the ball like that.
And 12,000, that number was really startling to me. 12,000 students transferred in that 1 year.
I can't imagine that would be as high in, you know, other cities or other states.
Well, now, but here's the question. I mean, is this also just about regular student mobility? I mean, you do see in low-income communities tons of mobility between schools, which isn't so much school choice as somebody moving to a different apartment or the kid goes from their grandma to their aunt or whatever, you know, is happening. And, you know, we did a little study in Dayton, Ohio, where we do a lot of on-the-ground work, and you saw a ton of this happening. You're talking about very poor communities. And, you know, they end up in whatever school they end up in. And most of the time, they're the same or worse. This is not an act of choosing schools. This is, you know, lives that are kind of chaotic. Dysfunctional. And, you know, the kids end up wherever they end up.
That's right.
All right. So what song do we have for this?
So since we're talking about school choice, we have Do You Ever Have to Make Up Your Mind by the Lovin' Spoonful.
Did you ever have to make up your mind and pick up on kissed the one and left the other one.
So, Janie, have you ever heard of the Lovin' Spoonfuls before?
No, I can't say that I have.
Yeah, that was
I'm not sure if it was before my time or just more obscure. I don't know.
I know. I think ever since Joe got here as our producer, we've been going for some more obscure stuff. I like it. I like
it's
it.
Good,
this is
good.
We're expanding. It's like when you're on Pandora and you hear songs you wouldn't have heard
exactly.
otherwise. We're the Pandora of education
we
policy.
We have a Pandora podcast.
Music. Ooh, I like that.
Just have us all on repeat.
Okay, it is now time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that? What up with that? Yes,
sir. Woo! Hey, Chris, welcome back to the show.
Mike, Janie, glad to be here.
Yeah, what's on deck?
Well, want to know what 2011 will bring to the field of education reform?
I do.
I'm no fortune teller, but I'm happy to offer these educated guesses. One, Kathy Black will be gone by Easter. A betting man might say that New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg
will... Hold on. Now, read that. Kathy Black will be gone by Easter?
Gone by Easter.
I think I've heard this somewhere.
I wrote this in a blog post just the other day. Actually, it was in the Education Gadfly a week and a half ago. That's my stuff. You can't just... What are you doing?
If I were to say that I simply forgot it was yours, and I completely understand why this is a major problem, would that make things any better?
No, it would not.
Well, that's exactly what ESPN news anchor Will Selva said recently after getting caught using a section of someone else's column on the air.
Wow.
In this new age of information, where just about anything can be Googled or Wikipedia'd, this is a prime example of how plagiarism is spiraling out of control. Plainly put, plagiarism is becoming an epidemic. It's deteriorating the quality of our literature and journalism, and younger people aren't taking it seriously. I can attest from my time as a teacher last year that students would countless number of times that students would take direct quotes from Wikipedia or other online sources that I could find easily by just typing their passage into Google, and it pops right up for me like it did for them. And when confronted by it, they don't really see it as a serious offense. Not so much of a funny what's up with that this week to start the new year, but what is up with that? What implications do you think this lack of seriousness with regards to plagiarism has on our future?
Well, I like that. When Chris is taking a more serious tone, it is, what is up with that? Rather,
it's very
than,
proper.
What's up with that?
Not that we stole that from anywhere.
No, exactly. Speaking of plagiarism. That's an excellent point, Janie. Touche. See, is that in the public domain? Yes.
You seem very passionate about this, Chris.
You know, it's something that really bothered me last year when I was working as a teacher. And not necessarily that they were doing it, but that they just really, when I'd call them on doing it, it was just almost as if, you know, you're pulling a prank. Like, oh, you caught me.
So
I'll get you next time, you know.
And so tell me how this works. So you're grading a paper, okay? And a phrase pops out that just does not sound like their writing in general, or like a 16-year-old kid's writing.
Yeah. I mean, it's fairly obvious, especially once you're reading 150 of the same, you know, the same type of writing about the same topic. You can pretty clearly tell when something is written by a 16-year-old versus written in the factual manner or, you know, academic matter that an online resource would have. So especially, you know, you sort of attribute it to certain students that may, you know, tend to do these things. But
so if I'm an internet entrepreneur, I would create a website that is like Wikipedia, but is poorly written and the syntax and style of a 15 or 16-year-old. Sounds like that could do quite well.
That sounds like the solution to this problem.
I mean, no, this is we've talked about this before about technology and what does it mean? You know, how do we make sure that these ethical standards are very clear to kids? And I think part of it is that we are uncomfortable in this culture more and more in talking about right versus wrong, you know, and talking in those kinds of moral terms, particularly in public schools, particularly, you know, look, and I know as a parent, you know, I mean, I don't like to talk to my child as if, you know, either you're good or you're bad. You read some of these old children's stories from way back when, and it's all about that, you know, the bad kids, and they're going to go sent to the, and that rubs us the wrong way. But, you know, this is an issue where I think there is right and there is wrong. And copying somebody else's work without citing it is wrong with a capital W.
Yeah, it's interesting that my first response, my initial instinct is, oh, well, then, you need to increase the punishment, because if they don't understand that it's something they shouldn't do, then when they do it, it'll be really bad. But you're right. It shouldn't be something that they don't do just because there's this huge punishment attached to it. There is some sort of ethical, moral fiber to this that I just don't think is coming across to a lot of students today. It's just simply easier. And, if what you're really going for is that grade and you can get away with this, that's great. Thumbs
right.
up.
Right. And a part of this has to be taught. I mean, the point is, you might read something on Wikipedia or whatever that is helpful and that helps, but you need to then put it in your own words. And what does that mean to put it in your own words?
Yeah, that's always a fine line, too.
Right. And that can be, you want to really absorb it and apply it. I mean, it's a little bit tricky, right? It's not necessarily something that's easy for kids to do. They have to be taught how to do this. But it's got to start by saying cutting and pasting, not okay.
Yep.
All right. Wish we could get Amber in here as a former English teacher, because I bet, of course, she was a former English teacher so long ago. Had they invented the internet back then?
That was
a little low, Mike. That was
I'm just teasing, Amber. I'm just teasing. All right. That is all the time we've got. Thank you, everyone, for a great show. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, don't forget to sign up for the Original Education Gadfly. This is our newsletter that goes out every week. It's got great stuff, including the kind of stuff that Chris was plagiarizing earlier. So sign up for that. Go to edexcellence.net. Till then,
I'm Janie Skull.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.